Okay, it's 9 o'clock, and I'm going to have to start, even though we only have a few on with us. I've been getting lots of emails, so it seems that many more people are listening, not live. I just want to make one comment and then pick up a little bit on the discussion we were having last class about the Irgun and Etzel, and then get back to what we're supposed to be doing. Regarding going on strike, I forgot to mention this last class. I was talking about the Chevron Yeshiva students. There is a book, the standard book about the history of YU is Jeffrey Gurok's book, which came out about 15 years ago. I have it here. Yeah. It's called The Men and Women of Yeshiva. It's more than 15 years ago, 1988. Although if you know Jeffrey Gurok's position at YU, he was also an assistant to Norman Lamb. So the problem with this book is that you have no analysis of the Lamb presidency, no critical analysis, and no discussion whatsoever of the election of Norman Lamb, which itself should have been something to write about, because there was a great split among the board between Norman Lamb and Emanuel Rachman. And let me say something else interesting, that I was at a funeral on Friday. Those, some of you might know the name Herb Smilowitz, longtime resident of my town. Quite a shock, actually, his passing. But there was many important figures, rabbis and others, at the funeral. And lo and behold, he was on the boards of many institutions. I was sitting right in front of Richard Joel. And he was sitting next to Dobrinsky, who's an assistant to something, as one of the deans of some sort at YU. And all I could say is that if I wanted to do an expose, I sat there for about 10 minutes listening to Richard Joel say all sorts of private stuff about the inner workings of YU, when I could have a very good story if I was a reporter at on the Jewish Week. Getting back to the story, what I'm mentioning, that's the second book, which has this great lacuna that they don't talk about the Lamb presidency. The first one was written by Gilbert Klapperman. I don't know if he's alive anymore. I met him about 5 years ago. He probably is the last student, if he is alive. I haven't heard otherwise. He might be the oldest musmach of YU alive, the last student of, or one of the last students of, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. He wrote a book, The Story of Yeshiva University, the First Jewish University in America. And if you look on pages 96 and on, he discusses a strike at Reitz. It wasn't called Yeshiva College then. It wasn't obviously not Yeshiva University either. In the first decade of the 20th century, the strike was about funds. That is, the students needed money, stipends. But the main reason was that they demanded a real curriculum of secular studies and wider Jewish studies, Hebrew language, etc. And when they didn't get that, they actually went on strike. So this business of striking has a long history. We got into the discussion last week of Bill says that he is alive but not well. He was the rabbi in, I think it was Lawrence, before, you know, the five towns were Jewish like they are, so Jewish like they are now. He also was in Charleston, if I'm not mistaken, one of his early rabbinates. We spoke about the Irgun, and I was speaking, as we say, al regalachas. I didn't have the facts in front of me, so I misspoke on a few things I want to correct, and then I want to add. For example, I wasn't sure who was the person from Lehi that was killed as soon as the British grabbed him. He was a wanted man. And I said David Raziel. David Raziel was actually Irgun, and he was killed, though, fighting on the British side in Iraq. He was killed because, as I mentioned, the Irgun, by the way, the Irgun had a treaty, as it were, not a treaty, I don't know what you call it, a hudna, if you want to use contemporary terms, with the British, and he was fighting against the pro-Nazi regime. Avraham Stern, the founder of the Stern Group, or the leader of the Stern Group, he was the one who was who I mentioned, who was killed in 1942, because they did not have this this ceasefire. Now, in terms of the Irgun, by the way, and Lehi, was involved in all sorts of wars, all sorts of battles against the British. One of the big ones was I was going on the Palestine Post earlier today. You can see it online. And the, I mean, when you read it, and I'm going to tell you some more Jewish terrorist attacks, you have to understand something. When you go to the papers of the Palestine Post, constantly you see Jewish farmer shot, two Jews shot by Arabs while driving. I mean, it was a constant series of attacks, nonstop, in the 30s and in the 40s. There was a Cairo-Haifa train bombing in 1948 in which Lehi mined the tracks north of Rehovot. They killed 28 soldiers. But we are talking more about Irgun. And I mean, the Lehi also assassinated in 1948 in Egypt Lord Moyne, who was the head of like British authority in that part of the world in the during World War II. Just a few things I want to correct. The first is, I have here, I'm holding in my hand, a list of all the Irgun attacks. And some of them were quite massive. And I was looking at the Palestine Post today about this. For example, July 25th, 1938, so you can go to the July 26th, 38 Palestine Post and you'll read about it, they planted a bomb. It says only one bomb. I think more than one. They killed 43 Arabs at a marketplace in Haifa. A month later, killed another 24 Arabs. If you go through the list, and I can send anyone the link, you have Arabs killed by bombs, you have British soldiers killed in various attacks. But the British embassy was bombed in Rome, by the way, and three people were injured. It goes through. Most were four and five, etc. Attacks, there was a bank robbery. I thought that there were more examples of hangings. In fact, there was only one. In July 29th, 1947, two kidnapped British soldiers were hanged. Now, at least that, according to the list I have, which is a very long list, you have plenty of British soldiers killed, assassinated, attacks on British camps. But this is the only one where I guess you could say killed in cold blood, these two. Now, if you go to the Irgun's website, it's etzel.org, and there's a whole discussion of this, that these three Jews were supposed to be hung in Akko prison, and in response to that, they kidnapped these soldiers, and Begin describes in the revolt that because of this, that is the killing the British soldiers who were left hanging in the wood near Netanya, and now the idea was that this would prevent any more executions by the British. The fact is that after that, no more executions were carried out by the British. Begin claims that this act, which he calls a cruel act, but a necessary act, was one of the things responsible for tipping the balance to the British withdrawal from Palestine earlier than it would have been. And on the Etzel website, it quotes this Colonel Archer Cassett, who was one of the senior officials in the British Mandate in Palestine, who in 1949, so this is right after the fact, right after the time, says that, quote, the hanging of the sergeants did more than anything else to get us out of Palestine. So it appears that it was becoming too expensive in human life, as well as other ways, for the British to remain in the land of Israel, and it was time for them to go. Now, the morality of this, not just the morality, the halachic legitimacy of this, we talked about last week, and I mentioned that the rabbis were opposed to it, most of the rabbis, at least, and Rabbi Katz was very much opposed to it. The one other correction I want to make is I spoke about the season in which the Haganah went after the Irgun, and I said that they didn't hand them over. That was not true. When I investigated, they did hand them over. They held them in their own prisons, and they did hand them over to the British, but apparently, and this is what the man I spoke to told me, which I misquoted, that they handed them over, but the deal with the British was that there would be no torture by British of Jews handed over. There was, however, the equivalent of torture, well, violent interrogations. I guess post-Bush administration, too, we call that torture. There was torture of the Irgun members by Haganah. Violent interrogations, however you want to put that. They beat members of the Irgun. No love was lost between them. So with that, that's just a summary of... Bill reminds me here before we start that Kenneth Hain, who there's a Scranton connection. I can't remember exactly what it is. He's a rabbi in Beth Sholem in Long Island. He's the synagogue where Kenneth Payne is rabbi. And Yisrael says the British decided they had enough of Mideast lunacy, Arab and Jew. Yeah. All I could say is, you know, we don't have time to go into it. And as far as I know, there is not a halachic article written on the behavior of the Irgun and Lehi and can it be justified halachically. It is a complicated situation. I mean, let's think back to World War II. Germans are bombing London. They're bombing civilian areas. Some people claim that the reason they bombed, you know, these certain areas in London, East End and all that, was because the Jews lived there. I don't think anyone takes that seriously. They were bombing civilians. So does that, you know, if your civilians are being bombed, are you then obligated to not to bomb their civilians, especially in a situation where you don't have bombs like we have today that are so exact and you fly over cities? You're going to say, you know, if that's going to weaken the enemy, you know, the enemy's bombing your civilians, how could you say you're not going to bomb their civilians? So if you look at it in that perspective, I'm not even saying this is halakhically correct, but just makes sense from a military perspective. Jews were being assassinated left and right by Arabs. So does that give then, today we would say, you know, we don't lower ourselves to that level, but that's how wars were fought in those days. And if the Jews, this was a terrorist war. Arabs with terrorist attacks against Jews. If the Jews didn't respond, what were they supposed to do? It's not like there was an Arab army in Palestine that the Jews could then attack. These were civilians. That is, they dressed as civilians, they looked like civilians, and they planted bombs. So there was no one for the Jews to respond against if they didn't respond in kind. At least you can make that case, perhaps. I don't know if it's halachic. I don't know if it's moral. And as I said, I don't know of any article or study that analyzes the actions of the Irgun and Lehi. I will say that we do regard them as heroes, Jewish heroes. Yisrael asked me last week, was there a response from the British? And I did say that they thought that Begin should not be allowed into England after when he became prime minister. There was attacks against synagogues in response to this. Yitzhak Shamir was head of Lehi, which was even more extreme, as I mentioned. They went to Beirut. I think I said to talk to the ambassador. It was not the ambassador, it was another German official in Beirut. They were involved in all sorts of terrorist attacks, freedom fighters, terrorists. What can I say? It's a hard situation, and it's a complicated situation. Let's put it that way. And it would be nice if someone would do a study of it from a halakhic standpoint. Were the British killing civilians? The British were not killing civilians. However, the British were not doing anything when the Arabs were killing civilians. They really had washed their hands of the whole thing, and the British were not allowing Jews into the land of Israel. The British were not allowing Jews to have arms to protect themselves. And so in that sense, the British were complicit, you could say, with what was going on. Let's continue where we left off. One of the things, the last thing we spoke about was, I mentioned, and this is how I ended, that Rav Reuven wanted to form a rabbinic organization, an international rabbinic organization. And I read you some of the names of great figures who signed on to this, and that one of the things this rabbinic organization would do would be to decide halachic questions, really taking away the individuality, and it would lead to more unity in halachic practice. I don't know if that's good or bad, but that was the plan. And I said that Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski opposed this. He quoted the Chafetz Chaim as saying that whenever you have rabbinic organizations, decisions end up being made by the officers, by the pikidim, not by the great rabbis, but by the functionaries. And that's been something we've seen over and over again. There's no question that that is correct. He writes this to Rav Reuven Katz. And as a result of this, Rav Reuven backs off this measure. Remember, Rav Chaim Ozer he studied with Rav Chaim Ozer in his youth. So instead, he contented himself with a smaller rabbinic organization just in his area of the land of Israel, local rabbinic organization. His theory, though, of rabbinic organizations, which he put into place in his local area, is quite interesting. Because his idea, and he wrote a whole essay on this, was that rabbinic organizations should be nonpartisan. And rabbis should be nonpartisan. This is something that his own teacher, Rav Chaim Moshe Grodzinski, was not nonpartisan. I mean, he was not really an active member per se of Aguda, like he was, but he was a member of it, and they did look to him for their various questions. Having said that, other organizations also looked to him, and the religious Zionists, many of them also looked to Rav Chaim Moshe, but he was associated with Aguda, and many other great rabbis were, you could say, literally card-carrying Agudistin, and really, maybe I'm not speaking strong enough about Rav Chaim Moshe, because when I say he lent his name to it, he was involved with it, he didn't agree with everything that went on, but he was an Agudistin, especially in the earlier years. He tried to convince Rav Chaim Soloveitchik to remain in the Aguda, so maybe take back what I said. He was really involved in Aguda. He was an Agudistin. Nevertheless, Rav Ruvain writes that this is not good for rabbis, rabbinic organizations, to be partisan. Let me read you some of what he wrote about this. And it's not just partisan not to be a member of the Aguda. It's the same, you shouldn't be a member of Mizrahi as well. He thought that people should be above that. So what's the role of the rabbi then? The role of the rabbi is to provide guidance. So you have an organization like Aguda, a lay organization, or a lay organization like Mizrahi. If there were halachic issues or spiritual issues, then they would have rabbis they turn to. But the rabbi would himself not be a member of it. He would not be tied to the organization. He would be above the organization. That's his model. He says as follows, that the great break that exists between the Mizrahi and Aguda is because each one of them regards the other as the enemy. If you're a Mizrahi, you regard Aguda as the enemy because Aguda is basically fighting against you and to achieve things. And it's the same thing from Aguda to Mizrahi. And therefore, if the rabbis are associated with Aguda, if you're a Mizrahi person, now all of a sudden you don't respect the Aguda rabbis. And vice versa as well. I mean, if you look at what's going on in Israel today, you see examples of this left and right. Therefore, Rav Ruvain says, that a rabbi who belongs to an organization will not have any influence on the opposing organization, the followers of the opposing organization. Just think for a minute what it would be like in Israel today if the rabbis were not really members of organizations, they just provided spiritual guidance, then they could have influence on everyone. And the Agudistin wouldn't feel that there's a problem with the other rabbis who are not theirs. He goes on, and he says that he talks about every time they wanted to appoint a rabbi in the land of Israel, it's not looking at who's the greatest Talmud Chacham, who could have the most influence. The first thing is to look, is the person an Agudist or a Mizrahi? If it's you're in an Agudist area, immediately the Mizrahi rabbi is Pasul, and if you're a Mizrahi, which was most of the places in those days, then the Aguda rabbis are Pasul. And Rav Ruvain Katz, although he's not a member of Aguda at all, and his son told me, Rabbi Leon Katz, that he tilted more towards Mizrahi, he still defends the Aguda, leading rabbis. He says that it's not right that the Mizrahi figures, they won't, you know, give as much respect as they should to the Aguda rabbis because the Aguda rabbis are in a different political party. He thinks it's unfortunate. He thinks it's unfortunate, first of all, that the Aguda rabbis are belonging to the party, but he also thinks it's unfortunate that because of that, non-Agudistin don't give proper respect to great rabbis. And then he says, quote, Kasher harav yeh bilti miflagti, when a rabbi will not belong to a party, az omed me'al l'kol inyanei ha-miflagot. He stands above all party disputes. And that's what we have in America by when it comes to American politics, because at least in most places, the rabbis are not supposed to get involved. They're supposed to remain apart from it, and most rabbis do. And that enables them to have good influence on everyone. Then he goes on to say, after explaining all the reasons why it's not smart for a rabbi to belong to a party, he concludes that what I mentioned, that nevertheless, we have to respect all rabbis. What you had in Palestine, in Eretz Yisrael, in the 30s and the 40s, was the Zionists, the religious Zionists dominated. And if you were an Agudist rabbi, you could not get a position in almost every place, because the Zionists would not allow you to get the position. Rabbi Soloveitchik, even though he was a cousin to Rav Meir Bar Ilan, they were family, he claimed that the reason he didn't get the position in, he didn't just claim that the reason he didn't get the position of chief rabbi at Tel Aviv was because he was not a member of Mizrahi, which is undoubtedly true. He also claimed that his cousin, the mayor of Bar-Ilan, who was family, made sure he didn't get it. I'm not saying that's the only reason. I mean, he was also young, but clearly all these positions, including Tel Aviv, which is perhaps the most important rabbinic, second most important rabbinic position in the land of Israel, was only going to be given to a Mizrahi. And that's how matters stood until the change about 20 years. But the right wing are no better, because when they took control, then they only put their people in. So it's what Reuven was talking about, is that everyone is making a mistake here, that the rabbis need to be above. And that's how it was. I've said this a number of times, that in Europe, if you were in a city, let's say you're in Minsk, and you're a Mizrahi, but the rabbi is an Agudas, it doesn't matter. You might not accept his views on religious politics, and you'll go to the Mizrahi convention, but if you have a shaila, if you have a question on the halachic matter, you go to your Rav, and vice versa too. If the rabbi is Mizrahi, and you were an Agudistan, you always went to the local Rav to ask him your shaylas. And the Agudas Rabbanim, the various Agudas Rabbanims in Poland, Lithuania, in the United States as well, were above politics. There was no politics allowed to be brought in, and you had Mizrahi and Aguda. And I've mentioned it before, I'll say it again, one of the biggest problems of the Haredi world is that they have created this system that rabbis are judged based upon their political viewpoint. It is them. It is the Haredi world that created this Ego HaZahav, that if you could be the greatest Talmudic scholar, but if you don't hold by their Das Torah, you are no longer regarded as qualified to decide matters of halacha, even though one thing has nothing to do with the other. You could be a great posek and yet have a different perspective. And this really goes back to Germany, to Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. But I believe that with all the good that the Haredi world has brought, we've spoken about it, one of the bad things, one of the worst things, is that they brought this idea that great Torah scholars are judged. And who are they judged by? They're judged by Balabatim, who can't even kiss the ground they walk on. So you have nobodies. You can read the Haredi press. You can read the Haredi English press. I don't need to mention names. They write for these various websites. Amaratzim, people, Balei Tshuva, who never had much learning when they were young, lawyers, I mean, not rabbis, and yet they feel that they can cast judgment on great Torah scholars. It boggles the mind, and that is, unfortunately, that was created by the Haredi world, and it continues, that the idea that we disqualify great rabbis because of their political outlook. This was never the way in Europe, and that's exactly what Reuven is speaking about, that the rabbis are supposed to be above this. Yes, Avraham, we mentioned this last semester, or two semesters ago, that the Marcheshes was Mizrahi, and Rephaim Moser was Aguda, and they sat on the same basin together, were the closest of friends. But that's how it was all through Europe, that Dayanim, Dayanim were members of different factions, and that's how it was in Eretz Yisrael also, early on. But not anymore, unfortunately. Reuven, let's go back to Reuven now. He was positively, very positively inclined to Eretz Yisrael and the creation of the state, which he sees as a product of open miracles. So I guess he should be called a Zionist. I'll read you some of the things he says in a few minutes. However, as one who lived in the land of Israel in the early years of the state, and he fought the religious battles, this often left him with a bad feeling about the leaders of the state, and he would criticize very strongly. And you'll see in a minute that if he's a Zionist, it's a very lukewarm Zionist. He's a lover of Eretz Yisrael, a lover of living in Israel, and a believer in the state, and this is a great miracle. However, in practice, as we'll see, he was quite disillusioned by the way the state operated. So that is Zionism, but more of a Soloveitchik sort of Zionism. Before the state was established, he wondered if there would be a violation of Lotach HaNeim. The idea, Lotach HaNeim is the commandment that means a few different things, but originally in context, you can't give non-Jews the land of Israel. The land of Israel is given to the Jewish people. And this, we spoke about the debate over Shemitah years, etc. And he said that if Jews make an agreement, that is through the UN, that we'll live in one area and the Arabs will live in another, we are therefore giving up our rights to a certain part of the land, is that a violation of Lo Tachanim? And he wrote to Rav Chaim Ozer about this. Rav Herzog, if you recall, also spoke to Rav Chaim Ozer about this. In retrospect, I don't see what the big problem is. And Rav Chaim Ozer answers it like in two lines, both to Rav Herzog and to Rav Reuven Katz. But you see that Rav Reuven and Rav Herzog, who, by the way, were quite close and perhaps discussed this among themselves, which is why they went to Rav Chaim Ozer, that Rav Chaim Ozer simply replies that it's not a problem because the British own the land. And we don't control the land. It's not like we're giving it up. The British are creating a framework, and when we say this, we accept to have this amount of territory, we're not giving up the other territory, we're just not getting it. We're agreeing to get a certain amount because a little is better than nothing, but since we don't have control of the other part of the land, we're not giving it up. So the fact that we agree to take a smaller area, we're not giving any imprimatur to the rest. We're simply saying that the rest will come to us at a future time. And as I said, that to me seems pretty obvious. But as I said, Rav Chaim Ozer discusses this in a few different places. Rav Reuven also thought, however, that there is no problem selling land in Israel to non-Jews if, in return, Jews are given land in Chutz La'aretz by non-Jews. And he thought that could be a solution to various problems, the issue of selling land to the Gentiles. He points to an explicit pasuk verse in 1 Kings where it says that Solomon, King Shlomo, gave some of the northern territory to Huram, who was the king of Tyre. And if you look at the Radak on that pasuk, it's in Perek Tet, he says that he did so. Why did Shlomo give him this land? In exchange for territory he got in Lebanon. And in fact, if you look at 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 2, it tells us that Huram indeed gave land to Shlomo. So therefore, this shows that the state of Israel, the land of Israel, that is, can be expanded, and you can also give up land. This, incidentally, would be a solution for those people who feel that there's a prohibition in giving up land to the Arabs if there's a compromise, that maybe they give us a little bit of land and we give them a little bit of land. But that's what Rav Reuven says. When a group of Zionist rabbis, however, came out with a special Yom HaAtzmaut service, complete with Torah reading and Haftarah, followed with a bracha, Shachrianu, the very service that, as I've spoken about in the past, Rav Soloveitchik got so upset about, Rav Reuven said that this is against halacha. He's so much like Rav Soloveitchik in some of his formulations. I'm going to talk about this next class. I don't think I'll get to it today, but I'll say it now as well. Some of you might know that after Rav Herzog died, there was a movement to bring Rav Soloveitchik as chief rabbi, and the telegram that came to Rav Soloveitchik was sent by Rav Reuven Katz. He was the top signatory asking Rav Soloveitchik to come become chief rabbi. Rav Reuven says that to create this new synagogue service with a halal with a bracha and haftarah and Torah reading and all that is against halacha, because we cannot add a new holiday to the calendar. That is what we call Bal Tosif. You're forbidden to add on something new. And this is exactly Rav Soloveitchik's approach. Rav Uziel, who was a Sephardic chief rabbi, great, great Torah scholar, we've had classes on him, who was involved in this new, quote, holiday, and a supporter of it, wrote to Rav Reuven and said, this isn't a new holiday in a halachic sense. There's no malacha, there's no prohibition on labor. The rabbis haven't said you can't work or anything. No new section was added to Shemona Esrei. And he says, therefore, Yom HaAtzmaut is just like Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av. And yes, why do we recite Hallel? Because there was a terrible war, and we emerged victorious, so we thank God. And, you know, there's some reasons. We can read an extra Torah, you know, a Torah portion, all these things. But as long as we're not messing around with Shemona Esrei and declaring that there's prohibitions on labor, so it looks like a biblical prohibition, a biblical holiday, we haven't violated anything. But Rav Reuven disagreed with that. In fact, Rav Reuven said, he tells us that, there were people in those days who made a Shechayanu on Yom HaAtzmaut. In fact, Rav Meshulam Roth, who's on Yisrael Kashkin's poster. Remember the poster we spoke about? And I encourage everyone to get it for your sukkah. It's all the great religious Zionist rabbis, or not all of them, but they are all great religious Zionist rabbis, and many of the great ones are on that poster. We'll have a classes on Rav Shlomo Roth. He paskin that you should say on Yom Ha'atzmaut Shehecheyanu. I haven't seen anyone, at least in my circles, who say Shehecheyanu, even when they say Hallel with a bracha. But Rav Reuven says it's absolutely forbidden to say Shehecheyanu, and he says one of the problems is that the people who... he's saying you can't say Shehecheyanu. They don't understand why you can't say Shehecheyanu. Because we make a Shehecheyanu on a new fruit. So why can't you make a Shehecheyanu about the state? The state is more important than a fruit or clothes. And he says it would be one thing to make a Shehecheyanu immediately after the war, when you conquered the land. But you can't make a Shehecheyanu 5 years later on such a bracha about something in the past. It has to be at the time of the event. That's what he says. So then he raises the question, which maybe you're thinking about as well. Didn't we just have Purim? Don't we say Shehecheyanu? Don't we say Shehecheyanu on Hanukkah? He says that the bracha of Shehecheyanu is not on account of the victory of the Maccabees, but on the lighting of the candles. Purim, it's not about Purim, the miracles of Purim. It's on the mitzvah. Megillah, you don't... That's what he says, at least. I'm sure if you look far, long and far, you'll find someone say otherwise. What did he do on Yom Ha'atzmaut? If you look at the hagiography on him, it states that he did not say Hallel with a bracha. What this means, I think, is that he said it with a bracha. Because if you say that he didn't say it with a bracha, otherwise you just say he didn't say Hallel. Like they say about Ritzi Pesach Frank, he did like Ben Gurion. No Hallel and no Tachanun. But with Rav Reuven, it records that he did not say Hallel with a bracha. Ergo, he said it without a bracha. But he did not see any halachic significance to Yom Ha'atzmaut. That would entitle you to say it with a bracha. But you can, saying it without a bracha is simply reciting to, you know, praise to God. And yes, you have to be thankful to God. But not with a bracha. Because a bracha, we don't have the authority. He also didn't say the prayer for the state of Israel that was established by the Israeli chief rabbinate, which includes the phrase Reishis Smichat Gvuloteinu. Instead, he said his own prayer along the lines of the Hanotein Shua Lamlachim prayer, that is the prayer we say for the leaders of government. This is also a reflection of the fact that the state, although the fact that God created a state is a wonderful thing, however, the structure of the state is not so wonderful. God gave us redemption, we now have a chance to make a state, a Torah state, something value, but at the moment it isn't. So you don't have this identification with the state per se, like we've seen among other rabbis. Instead, you have an identification with the fact that God gave us a possibility to create a state. It's a great thing that he gave us this, and now we don't have to be ruled by the non-Jews. But at present, the state still has a lot of problems, and he never would consider it holy, or in the sense that Ritzi Yehuda Cook or others would. He continued saying his own prayer, even after the chief rabbis asked him not to, and Rabbi Maimon and others, said that, why diverge from us? Yet, but his position was between the religious Zionist position and the Agudas position, somewhere in the middle. He also was one of those who pushed the issue in the chief rabbinate council. He was one of the elder rabbanim in the chief rabbinate council against Sherut Lumi law. That is, you had this dispute early on in the state about the army, for men and for women. For men, we know what happened. There was, 300 people, full-time Torah students. Ben-Gurion made a deal, and fast forward 60 years, and you know where we are now. Although really it was Begin who added a lot of teeth to it to allow it to expand the exemptions unlimited. The real issue, though, because no one assumed, everyone assumed in 1948, and this includes even the figures in the so-called Haredi world, which wasn't really called Haredi then, but the Chazon Ish and all of them, all assumed that if you're not learning, you go to the army. And they did go to the army in those days. People who today, Rav Chaim Kanievsky was in the army. Can you believe it? But he was. Everyone assumed that if you were not learning full time, he was in the army, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, he was called for some special emergency thing. There's a whole story about that. But he actually served in defense. But the parents of the grandparents of many people learning today were in the Army because they weren't learning full time. Other than this 300 or was it 400 people learning, everyone went to the Army, and there was a religious unit, the whole bit. There was no conception like there is today that you don't go to the Army. And this is another one of the major, I think today people realize it. It's because they've been open about it recently, but they've only been honest in the last few months. For a long time, the Haredi world was telling people that their opposition to the Army is because Torah sa umnaso, that, you know, you're learning full time. They've now finally been honest. Just in the last few months, I've been saying this for years, that the Haredi position is, it has nothing to do with learning. The Haredi position is that no Haredi should go into the Army. And it doesn't matter what structure the Israeli government establishes, a Nachal Haredi, anything like that. There was a time when Rav Steinman supported Nachal Haredi, but the standard Haredi position today is that by virtue of being a Haredi, no Haredi should have to go into the Army because it will be destructive of their lifestyle. This is an argument that it took them 30 years to admit it publicly, and they finally have now admitted it. But it began with just yeshiva students going to the Army, and then as this became a lifestyle choice that every young Haredi man learns and doesn't go to the Army, then all of a sudden there was a new model that the Army is not a place for Haredim because it doesn't have any structure to it. It's going to destroy their lifestyle. And the truth of the matter is, there's some truth to that, that the Haredi lifestyle would be destroyed by being in the Army. But the issue, the big issue in 48, therefore, because there wasn't really dispute about the men. Everyone assumed the men go to the Army. And even the Eda Haredi types, some of them helped out in 1948. The issue was women. In those days, women did not go to no armed forces in the world had women in it. And yet Israel was a small country, and they needed every hand they could get, and you had women who were doing guard duty at various kibbutzim, which they needed. And the idea was that this is just natural, we need the women, and we're going to put women in the Army. This became a huge issue. Rav Herzog also was at the forefront of this, the idea being that the Army would lead to sexual immorality, men and women sleeping together in Army camps. I don't mean sexually sleeping together, but just like being right next to each other. It's not going to lead to the Torah framework that they're looking for. And this they went to the mat. Not just, obviously, the Haredim, who regarded it as Yehari Galyavar, but Rabbi Herzog also. He went to the mat on this and said, this is absolutely cannot happen. Whereas the religious Zionist rabbis supported the Sherut Leomi law, that if you don't go to the Army, the women should go do Sherut Leomi, national service. The Army, everyone agreed no. So then the question is about Sherut Leomi. By the way, I have unpublished a long, long tshuva, about 15 pages by Rav Herzog about women going to the Army, in which he's against it, but he says it's not Yehari Vayava or anything like that. I hope to publish it one day. So then the issue was the Sherut Leomi law. The law was supposed to be, this was the hope of people like Ben-Gurion, that women who don't go to the Army will then do national service. Because everyone in the state has just started, everyone has to do their part. What would national service be? What work at a hospital? Things like that. And what could be the problem with doing national service? However, and the religious Zionist rabbis all assume that this is a great thing. Because of the disputes, however, even that did not become a law. Instead, it became something volunteer. Rav Herzog and others didn't see any problem with it. Rav Reuven Katz, however, really agreed with the Haredim that you cannot make this a law, and therefore this led to a compromise. For the Haredim, Sherut Leomi was also regarded as Yehareg Val Yavar. So what could possibly be Yehareg Val Yavar? That is, when they say martyrdom, they don't mean martyrdom. They meant if it actually was passed and every young woman would have to go Sherut Leomi, what it would mean was that they'd send the young women to America or England. Because the Haredi leadership said that any system in which you take young women, 18 years old, and put them in a surrounding, even if they go home every day and live at home, in which they are under someone else's authority, not their parents' authority, that will lessen their Judaism, and that will lead to them breaking with the Haredi lifestyle. It was ironic to a certain extent, because some of these same Haredi women who, for religious reasons, cannot go into the Army, because it's against their religious, cannot do Sherit Lomi, cannot work in hospitals because it's against their religious principles, all you have to do is go to Jerusalem and you'll see that they are working. They're working at banks, they're working in offices, and it's hard to figure out why it's okay for a girl to work at an office building and come home every day and not work at the hospital. And the Haredi answer, and they've said this, is there's a difference. The girl who's working in the office, she's her own boss. She chooses to work, and she chooses she'll quit if things are not in line with her ideas. But in the Sherit Lulmi system, even if they're working at the hospital, this will be by law, and they'll be under someone else's control, and therefore, who knows what it's going to lead to. And it's even today, when Sherit Lulmi is volunteer, the Haredi world still says it's absolutely forbidden to be part of it, because once you join it, you're part of the system. And the system is the Zionist system, and you can't have anything to do with that. I think this whole Zionist system explains, it's very hard for people on the outside to grasp the Haredi mentality, because it doesn't work with some of our values, but there is a logic and there is a consistency. But from the outside, it often appears to be a cruel logic. You had these big protests the last couple of weeks. I think for the average person, they can maybe understand why the Haredim won't say the prayer for the state of Israel. That they can understand, Zionism, all that. What the average non-Haredi, and I think lots of Haredim, can't understand either is why Haredim will not say a prayer for the soldiers. They want the Israeli army to win there's wars. It's the soldiers who are keeping the Arabs from killing them, and yet even this idea of saying a prayer, saying a Misha Berach, saying Tehillim, saying anything, for the because it's connected to the state, therefore you can't even say a prayer for the soldiers, a Misha Berach. And believe me, they believe in Misha Berach. They say Misha Berach anytime someone is ill or anytime there's a problem, but you can't say a Misha Berach for the soldiers, because that is connected to the state. But you see how, what an Olam Hafuch, what a backwards world we are in, that for a community that really believes in the power of prayer, because of the political situation we're in, they don't feel that they're able to even say a prayer for the soldiers, who should be separate, I would think, from the state. And in the early years, there wasn't this issue. Haredi rabbis would have no problem saying a prayer for the soldiers. The state, that was a different thing. And many Haredi leaders, by the way, had no problem saying the prayer for the state as long as you got rid of the words Reshit Smicha Gulatenu. But today, the divergence is so great that anything which smacks of identification with the state of Israel is regarded as pasul. Getting back to Rav Reuven Katz, so we see conservative elements of him here, opposing Sherit Lulmi law. I'm not saying opposing Sherit Lulmi, but opposing the law, not reciting the prayer for the state of Israel that the other rabbis do, even though he's an advocate of the state of Israel. Let me read you, by the way, something which he said when the state was... I'll get to it in a minute. Some of the positive things he says about the state. Let me go back in time to the 1930s to show you also a conservative element in his thinking. We spoke, when we dealt with Reb Chaim Moser and Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg, about the plan to move the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin to Eretz Israel. And who is the strong voice opposed to it? The only voice opposed to it among the senior rabbis in the land of Israel? That's Rav Reuven Katz. He takes the lead in opposition. And as the rabbi of Petach Tikva, one of the elder rabbinic statesmen, this is an important role he's playing. And it's not an accident, I don't think, that Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski was the leader of the opposition outside the land of Israel. They did this in tandem. You can even read in the letters of Rav Chaim Moser in volume 3, pages 232 and 274, you have the letters of Rav Chaim Moser to Rav Reuven Katz, warning him about this idea, this plan of transferring the rabbinical seminary, and how we have to put a stop to it. And he speaks about the same things he says to he said to Rabbi Weinberg and others, that when the rabbinical seminary of Berlin was established in Germany, it had great reason to fight the reform. However, what are we going to do to bring it to the land of Israel? We don't need, he says, in Israel, rabbis im hakultur ha'ashkenazi, Shechriv et Olam. He says German culture has destroyed the world. He's writing this in 1934. He means destroyed Judaism, basically, that it turned, you know, it's the beginning of reform. He says we don't need German culture in the land of Israel, and we don't need these types of rabbis. That is, Israel Hildesheimer's seminary was an emergency measure to stop the spread of reform. In his letter to Mayor Hildesheimer, he even calls the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, Mayor Hildesheimer was the rector, the son of Israel Hildesheimer, he calls it a rabbinic factory, Beit Charoshet Rabbanim. In the second letter he wrote to Reuven Katz, he says basically the same thing, that we have to keep this out, it's a danger. You know, the idea, the rabbis, the German rabbis are not the old-fashioned rabbis, the great Talmudists, etc. What does Reuven say? Reuven writes an article to defend this position. And this is where he really offended the German Orthodox Jews. Let me read you what he writes. Because the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, and this was explained in three long letters, from Rav Meir Hildesheimer to Rav Chaim Moshe Grodzinski. I published these three letters in my doctoral dissertation, but I have not yet published them in a journal or anything. One day I will. He has three letters, and he explains to Rav Chaim Moshe that although we are centered in Germany, we never regarded ourselves as a German institution. On the contrary, we regard ourselves as a Torah institution that could affect the entire world, and especially if you look at the land of Israel, where there's such secularism there, we need to be there because it's our form of Judaism that could be attractive to modern Jews. But Reuven doesn't think so at all. And he says, the YU, by the way, has the same idea about their institution. What does Reuven say? He says that, before I get to Reuven, let me read you what Rabbi Binyamin said. Rabbi Binyamin is the name of, it's the pen name of a Jewish writer, a religious Jewish writer, very much of a leftist. Him and Buber were involved in this idea that there should be one state for Jews and Arabs. But he wrote about how in one of the religious newspapers how important it is to bring in the rabbinical seminary. And he writes that you have these old-fashioned rabbis who try to speak to the modern crowds, and what it is, he says, Hatochen, their sermons, Hatochen Yalduti, that is, for us, he's saying, the Tochen, the content of their sermons, their drashot, are childish. Asara, he says, Tentfachim below, you know, our cultural level, and he says, it's Sar Baalei Chayim. That is, we're the Baalei Chayim. It's difficult for us to listen to it, and therefore he says, we need rabbis who can appeal, who can give a speech before a kahal intelligenti on the holidays, etc., not to create a chilul Hashem. What Rabbi Binyamin is saying is that the intellectual community, and this is a German community to a large extent in the land of Israel, they need rabbis who are culturally aware. I think we can all appreciate from our own perspective what he's speaking about. But Reuven responds to this letter. This is in there was a journal, this Torah journal called Hahed. You can see it on HebrewBooks.org, I believe, some of the issues. And he responds, and one of his points was to put the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin in its place. He says as follows. I'll just summarize for you. He's saying that before the war, he's saying, before World War I, he's talking about, and even after World War I, but he says at least before World War I, no rabbi in Eastern Europe would ever come from the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, because the Berlin rabbis are not learning enough. What do? He says, they learn a little Gemara, they learn a little Shulchan Aruch, and then they get the doctorate. That maybe is needed in Western Europe, but it's not needed in the land of Israel. And he continues that, he really speaks, he says that the Iker Halimun Meruchas Buniversita, he says that their main learning is at the university. And the Torah is tafel, really offensive things to speak about. The same way some people, I guess, spoke about YU. And then he says that if you create such an institution, you know, where are you going to study to get your doctorate? Like in Germany, they receive doctorates. They'd have to they turn the yeshiva. I don't know why you can't study in Hebrew University, but he's saying that you turn the yeshiva into a doctorate type of granting institution. And if you're not going to do that, if you're going to go to the university, well, then fine. Then what do you need a rabbinical seminary? Have a traditional yeshiva and go to the university. Rabbi Weinberg, when he saw this article, was outraged and offended. He even said that the students of the rabbinical seminary should protest this. I published his letter against Rav Reuven Katz. He points out also that in earlier years, Rav Reuven Katz had been in communication with him in Berlin because one of Rav Reuven's sons, he wanted to send him to Berlin to get smicha there. If you look in Kitvei Rabbi Weinberg, Volume 2, page 352, you'll see the letter from Rabbi Weinberg. I took out Rav Reuven Katz's name. I put an ellipsis in, because in rabbinic journals, you don't, in Torah publications, you don't put names in like that. But I identified him in the biography as well. Rabbi Weinberg wrote to Rabbi Chaim Moshe Brzezinski and expressed himself this way. This is a famous letter, which I also included in my doctoral dissertation. Subsequently, it's been printed in a number of places. I printed it in the Kitvei Rav Weinberg as well. He says to him, "Are we a rabbinic factory?" That's what Rav Chaim Moshe called the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. "Do we make rabbis?" Make in quotes, osim. "We make that the Torah is not forgotten in Germany. And who created this love of Torah in Germany," he says, "if not us?" And he goes on to say that smicha here is very hard. He says, "You should come see Berlin. People are learning in the Beis Midrash till late at night. And that the fact that they study some secular subjects doesn't take away from it." He says it is a lot harder to get smicha in Berlin than it is to get in Eastern Europe, where people go when they spend one zman at a yeshiva, and then they're given smicha. He says, "We are a yeshiva," he says, "in the full meaning of the word, and we measure up to any yeshiva in the East. And therefore," they say, he says, "Rav Chaim Moser, you have to support us and not be opposed to us." And Rav Chaim Moser, as I mentioned, he didn't see it that way. He saw the whole idea of a rabbinical seminary in which you combine it with secular subjects as something, it's bringing in a false version of the rabbinate to the land of Israel. Now, Rabbi Reuven also wrote an article on this in which he included in his Shar Reuven, which are his collected essays. This is on page 107 and on. And he speaks about why we need rabbis from the old school. If you look back now, I think you can do a good study and see, you know, who was right on this dispute. My own perspective is that people like Rav Reuven and Rav Chaim Moser were wrong and made a mistake that only in recent years, perhaps, have they begun to rectify. And that Rabbi Weinberg, who didn't believe in moving the seminary because he thought it needed to stay in Germany because there was a future for Jews in Germany, but had no difficulty whatsoever with the seminary, the ideology being in the land of Israel. In fact, I will be publishing a letter soon from Rabbi Weinberg in which he explains, even after the war, how important it is to have a Torah im Derech Eretz, a rabbinate, in the land of Israel. Which you can't, when the state was founded, even before the state, the old-fashioned rabbi simply couldn't speak to the modern Israelis. And there was a huge culture gap there. And that's why you needed, not to replace the yeshivos, but in retrospect, had you had an institution like the seminary, you would have had the development of a religious intelligentsia, and the irreligious elements would not have been so strong as they were. But Rav Reuven sees it differently. He says that what we need is rabbis from the old school, not rabbis with doctorates. He does say, and this shows that he is a moderate, he says that there's no problem with a rabbi having secular knowledge, but that only comes after he fills himself with Torah. Not at the same time. Someone like Rav Herzog, who has a doctorate, that's a big Kiddush Hashem for someone like Rav Reuven. And that is of great value, both for the outside world and also even in Torah studies, for science and things like that. But it only can come after the Torah scholar has filled his belly, as they say, with Torah. But the idea that a rabbi needs to have a doctorate, like in Germany, had to be the rabbiner doctor, that he sees as destroying the intensive Torah study and really foreign to the whole idea of what Torah is all about. That's the traditional view. He also, as I mentioned, in the same letter that Raphael Moser writes to him, I mentioned this last class, I'll just repeat it again, the idea of the agricultural yeshiva, where they would learn and also work the land. Very nice idea, perhaps. But Rav Chaim Ozer was opposed to it. He wrote to Rav Reuven. They were afraid. Rav Chaim Ozer was afraid. Rav Reuven was afraid that young men from established yeshivas would go to this agricultural yeshiva because they felt it would be a way of providing them with a parnassa in the future. And I commented already how afraid of competition they are. Rav Reuven, very afraid. He doesn't want to give people options because if you create the agricultural yeshiva, people are going to drop out of the regular yeshivas. The plan for this agricultural yeshiva was actually under the direction of Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin from last semester. And nevertheless, Rav Reuven opposed it. In a recent blog post, I mentioned, however, that the Chafetz Chaim, none other than the Chafetz Chaim, said that yeshiva students in Eretz Yisrael should learn 9 months a year and 3 months a year they should work the fields. And I also showed in that post that yeshivas Kol Torah, which is the yeshiva identified with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, it is actually founded by German Orthodox immigrants. That yeshiva, the original plan of it was that some of its students after yeshiva would go work on the Orthodox kibbutzim. There was a couple Poalei Agudas Yisrael kibbutzim identified with the German Orthodox, in particular Kibbutz Chafetz Chaim and Shalvim, and that was the idea. I even showed you a picture, if you read the blog, of how they dressed in the Kol Torah Yeshiva. They were learning outside with the Rebbe, and the guys were wearing shorts. It was very different than it is today. But this was a model that came from Germany, but Rav Reuven didn't accept it. I'm going to have classes on Rav Yochanan Wasserman, maybe even next semester, because he is a fascinating figure. But I want to tell you about a dispute now between Rav Yochanan Wasserman and Rav Reuven Katz, and a dispute that Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski was on Rav Reuven's side, even though Rav Yochanan Wasserman was his brother-in-law. In the early 1930s, there was a controversy over what we call Avodah Ivrit, Hebrew labor. I don't know why they called it Ivrit, Avodah Ivrit, not Avodah Yehudit, but just like I don't know why they called it Mishpat Ivri, Hebrew law, not Mishpat Yehudi, but that's what they called it, Avodah Ivrit. The situation was that there was a lot of unemployment, Jewish unemployment, in the land of Israel, and yet people were hiring Arabs as they were cheaper. That's the free market. Rav Reuven, among others, but Rav Reuven was a rabbi, so he's writing from a religious perspective, spoke out about this, and he published a special article on the topic of Avodah Ivrit, that we don't hire Arabs, we hire Jews. However, and this makes a lot of sense, I had to figure to say, well, it costs more money. That's, I guess, for the religious leaders to determine. Clearly, if the Jewish worker is going to charge three times what the Arab worker is and you can't afford it, you're not going to hire the Jewish worker. However, if it's the difference is not that great, and we do have an obligation for tzedakah, so you'd hire the Jewish workers. Rav Yochanan Wasserman, however, writes a letter to Poalei Agudas Yisrael. That was the Jewish workers' party of Agudas Yisrael. Agudas Yisrael had a workers' element to it. They later would split, but at this time they weren't. And it was published in the Aguda newspaper in Eretz Yisrael, in which he said that when it comes to Avodah Ivrit, Poalei Agudas Yisrael should not cooperate with the Zionists, and they should prefer Arabs over non-religious Jews. Again, Rav Yochanan Wasserman said that Poalei Aguda, they should hire Arabs instead of the non-religious Jews. Furthermore, he didn't see how you could compel Jews to hire other Jews over Arabs when this would require more money. We'll stop here now because we really got to unpack this debate next class. So let me end here and take any questions. I think we'll have one more class on Rav Reuven Katz next week, but let me, I'm just whetting your appetite about Rav Yochanan because people today don't realize that Rav Yochanan Wasserman was really an extremist in certain areas. Today his writings are reprinted by the Satmar. It is hardly Aguda. His attitude is really Satmar-oriented and very much out of the Lithuanian mainstream. And in his lifetime, he was involved in all sorts of disputes. He's, of course, a kadosh, and therefore we have to give him all the honor. But during his lifetime, his outlook really diverged from the mainstream Lithuanian perspective. Now, Yisrael says, would he belong on the religious Zionist poster? And it's a hard question. I told you I asked his son, and his son said he tilted more to Mizrahi than Aguda, and he did speak. Next class, I'll give you some examples of some of the things he said about the miracle, the great miracle of the establishment of the State of Israel. But he didn't identify with, what the great miracle was, the fact that Jews now have freedom. They're not ruled by the Arabs. They can control their destiny. But he never saw the actual state itself as something to rejoice over because of all the problems. So in that sense, I don't really see him as a religious Zionist so much. He's not anti-Zionist because he's hopeful and he hopes that things will develop differently. And he's not Agudist, but he's somewhere in the middle. So I wouldn't put him on the religious Zionist poster. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik belongs on the religious Zionist poster, despite his lukewarm Zionism to a certain extent. He did write important essays, and he was was a member of the Mizrahi Party, and he suffered for it. He was not a super Zionist in the sense that that everyone has to go on Aliyah or anything like that. In that sense, Rav Reuven was more of a Zionist, because Rav Reuven did think they should go on Aliyah, but Rav Soloveitchik was involved in Zionism. He was a member of Mizrahi. He cast his lot with them. So he is a real Zionist, just not a Messianic Zionist. Yisrael says that Rabbi Wasserman, although an extremist, complimented the Rav. I never saw somebody eat, sleep, and dream Torah as he did, he said about the Rav. He came to Dublin, and he stayed with Rav Herzog, and they had a nice relationship. He did not have a nice relationship with Rav Kook. And he said terrible things about Rav Kook, though. But why would he not compliment the Rav? The Rav in those days was a member of Aguda. And better question would be what he said about the Rav's father, which I don't know. The Rav's father, who taught at the Mizrahi Institution. Rav Hanan Wasserman refused to come to speak at YU when he came. It wasn't YU then. It was Yeshiva College, Reitz. So he might have said this about Rabbi Soloveitchik. I don't know when he said this, and if he really did say it, or if it's just a legend. But I believe the story is when he went to Boston. He came to America in 1938 to raise money, end of 37, early 38, to raise money. But he refused, even though Dr. Revel sent Rav Chaim Zimmerman, who was a top Talmud and a genius of geniuses, to try to convince Rav Hanan Wasserman to come speak, even though all the other Rosh Yeshiva came to Reitz. Rabbi Hanan Wasserman refused to come to Reitz. Not only did he refuse to come to Reitz, when there were students in Europe who had a chance to get out of Europe, not when the Holocaust was going on, but in the late 1930s, and the only way they could get out was through visas to Yeshiva College or Skokie, he said, better not to go. He said, not only better, don't go, because although here there's physical dangers in America at those institutions, there are spiritual dangers. So, just see how different this is. Rav Shimon Shkup taught at Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. And all the other Lithuanian Gedolim came to give Shirim there. So he had a different outlook. There's no question about it. Even Rav Aaron Kuller, who was also somewhat extreme, he gave a shir at Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan or Rav Aaron Kuller. So I really think Rav Elchanan Wasserman is, we say, sui generis in his attitudes. His view is much more like Hungarian outlook than the Lithuanian outlook. But we will see in my new book, which I'm reading right now, the final typescript before I send it in. They sent it back to me, and next thing I'll see, I'll be done within a week, the next thing I'll see will actually be the printing, the galleys. Rabbi Hanan Wasserman also had some very interesting things to say about the role of women, and how a man should always marry beneath him, because that makes a good marriage. It's a fascinating figure. We'll have time. I'm going to do classes on him. Let's see, who else? Yisrael says, the Chanoch Cohen said in his essay in the second book of Narah Goes to the Rav. Yeah, I mean, the story is, I have no reason to doubt it. The story is that when Rabbi Hanan Wasserman went to Boston, that was, and the Rav was not even at YC then. He was the Rav of Boston. He had an institution up there, and the Rav was a genius. Yisrael says he heard that Rav Aaron Kugler tried to get Rav Soloveitchik to oppose drafting of women, but the Rav won't join in. True. That I haven't heard. I don't know what the Rav's position on that was. It doesn't sound right, though, because the religious Zionist world was uniformly opposed to the draft of women. Some of them thought that women could enlist, but to draft women, I never heard that the Rav supported that. I think I told you the story once, so I'll say it again in case you have new people. When I was driving with Rabbi Jafter, and I'll never put this in print, and please, any of you who are listening, don't put it on the blog. Why won't I put it in print? The Rav said it. It expresses an important view. Because, I don't feel that he said something about his grandson, Rabbi Lichtenstein, who's now a rabbi in Muncie, who became a Haredi, and I think it's inappropriate for an outsider like me to report something in which might hurt the feelings of his grandson publicly, that is, in print. Would you like to see your grandfather saying something about you to some stranger, someone you don't know, someone who hardly knew the Rav? It would be very hurtful, I think. But what when we drove the Rav back once, or drove him to the Kollel, he started talking about how his family in Israel and how one of his grandsons, that's his grandson, Yitzhak, he doesn't understand that you need an army. And that, you can't not go to the army. Jews need to go to the army. And he said, and this is what he said, Bezel Lashon. He doesn't understand that you need, he doesn't understand that you need an army. So this was a criticism of the idea that his grandson is not enlisting. And then Rabbi Jachter asked him, well, what about Sherut Leumi? What could be wrong? And he quoted Rav Amital, what could be wrong with Sherut Leumi, just working in hospitals? And the Rav didn't say a word. He looked out the window, and Rabbi Jachter asked him again. And it's not like he didn't hear him. He heard him fine, especially the second time. And I'm curious, you should ask Rabbi Jachter if he remembers the story like I do, because he definitely remembers the story of Thanksgiving the same exact way that I remember it when we asked him about Thanksgiving. But the Rav refused to answer the question. So that, what I took away from that is that the Rav didn't even want to get involved in the Sherut Leumi issue, which was so problematic. So the idea that he didn't oppose drafting of women, I find hard to believe. Avram says, the image of Rav Wasserman seems diametrically opposed to the Chafetz Chaim. Now, it's hard to say that, Rav Hanan Wasserman was one of the great students of the Chafetz Chaim. He was more closely tied to the Chafetz Chaim. He might have been the Talmud Mufak of the Chafetz Chaim, more closely tied to the Chafetz Chaim above all else. But Rav Hanan Wasserman, he didn't think that any of his ideas diverged from the Chafetz Chaim, as far as I know. It's hard to make the case that the Chafetz Chaim held all of his ideas. But he battled. He was opposed at the Marienbad Convention when Aguda decided to support the establishment of the state. Rav Hanan Wasserman was one of the few, together with Rav Aaron Kugler, who voted against it, that they did not support the establishment of the state. So, what can I say? Let's wait until we do our classes on Rav Hanan Wasserman, because, like I said, it's sometimes you get these figures who seem to be out of place. His ideas, he's always fighting in the Aguda against what he thinks are the liberalizing tendencies. He would fit in very well in Hungary, and then you have some rabbis in Hungary who are like Israel Hildesheimer and others who seem out of place, that they would fit in much better in Lithuania or in Germany. But let's wait till we go do those classes. Now, according to Wikipedia, Yisrael says Clifford Martin, one of the hanged soldiers, might have been a Jew, as his mother came from a Jewish family in Cairo. So if you have your gun, killing a Jew. But it's not the only time. There were Jews killed in the King David Hotel. They gave the warning, but still, you have to expect that Jews are going to be killed. And you know something? If I'm in the Irgun in 1946, 47, 48, and there's a Jew who's in the British Army, at the end of the day, he might be Jewish, but he's the enemy. He's serving to prevent the Jewish state from being established. So the fact that he's Jewish doesn't mean, you know, that he'd be putter. You know, it could be Menachem Begin had such a Jewish heart that I have to believe that Menachem Begin, it turns out that some soldier, it turns out he's Jewish, Menachem Begin would never have hung him. By the way, the only person ever killed by the Jewish Defense League was a Jewish woman. If you remember when the Russian ballet was supposed to come to America and they bombed this office building for this organization in New York, this travel company that was coordinating the visit of the Russian performers, it was a Jewish woman whose name escapes me, who was a secretary there. She was killed. Rav Katz expresses his views on Zionism in various articles, all of which have been collected in this volume, which you can get on HebrewBooks.org, Shar Ruvein, Davar Be'ito. This is all of his essays on matters of the day. Another question, Yisrael is typing. Wait till the last questions come in, and I'm trying to find something here to show you also. Okay, Yisrael's has to disagree with my analysis on the permissibility of killing a Jewish British soldier if he stands in the way of founding the state. I didn't know I gave an opinion on the permissibility, Yisrael. Already at the beginning of the class, I said that I'm not sure whether any of this is permissible. What I did say, however, is two things. One is that Menachem Begin had such a Jewish heart, I have no doubt that if one of these soldiers was known to him as Jewish, he would not have touched a hair on his head. And I also said, however, that for the Irgun, you know, the Irgun is not just Begin. For the Irgun as a whole, a Jew in the army, I assume, would be regarded as a traitor. And that the fact that, you know, he was Jewish wouldn't change things, that, you know, if they'll hang him. What can I say? Whether that's permissible, I have no idea if this is permissible. I have serious questions about the whole business of Yirgun and Lehi, planting bombs in markets. I mean, just because the Arabs were doing it, does that mean we should do it? I don't think today there's a religious leader. If someone's in Israel, ask Rav Lichtenstein. I mean, he's a religious leader. Do you think it's permissible, Rav Aharon, to what the Irgun did, what Lehi did? I'd like to know. I don't think today any religious leader would say that in contemporary times we can do it. Maybe so I don't have an answer to that. So Avram asks, did Hirsch have a famous quip about rabbis becoming doctors? I don't know. He might have. I'm not sure. You know, Hirsch did not have a doctorate. Sometimes people assume he did. He only was at university for 1 year. But I don't know about any quip about him becoming a doctor. Rabbi Unterman, when he came to, I heard this from Professor Altman, Rabbi Dr. Altman, when Rabbi Unterman came in the early 30s to Berlin, to the rabbinical seminary, he said that there's too much Derech Eretz here and not enough Torah. He said it about the rabbinical seminary. And the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, I think it was more intensive than YU even. And finally, Yisrael says, what is the real complaint about the army and the draft? I never hear more than hysteria and hyperbole. Is the environment not so kosher? There's a few complaints as I see it. One is, you're associating with Zionism. You're having involvement with Zionism, and that's a problem. For others, the problem is the environment. What do I mean the environment? Okay, so you have Nachal Charedi, but even Nachal Charedi is not the Charedi per se environment. And I think the fundamental reason is, I mean, even if they created a base medrash where they could learn, if they created a situation where the Charedi soldiers could learn 6 days a week, and the seventh day they're in their own closed environment doing stuff, they still would not agree to send them there because it's acknowledging the reality of the state of Israel, and it's acknowledging the value of the state of Israel, that you're contributing to the society, and it's putting your people in a system in which there's another value. That is the state of, if you're in the army, then the state of Israel is a value. You take an oath of allegiance to it, and that the state is not a religious state. And that they can never accept a situation where their soldier, where the Haredi young men are put in that situation when there's another value pulling at them. Patriotism, for instance. If you're in the army, we expect you to be patriotic, to value the state of Israel. That is not a value of the Haredi world. And that to me is the fundamental reason. Now, there's also, clearly, the people who are learning Torah, they don't want them to not learn Torah. But as is, was made clear in the last few months, it's not only about Torah study, because they insist that anyone, even if you're not learning Torah, should be exempt from the draft. Which, how can a country do that? Okay, well, thank you all, and look forward to seeing you next week. Good night, everyone.